Welcome to NatSec Tech, a podcast from the Special Competitive Studies Project. I'm Jean Meserve. One of the great things about hosting this podcast is that I almost always learn something new from our guests about how a technology works, what it could do, what problems it can solve. But in this episode, the learning curve is steeper because I had never heard of the subject, energetics. With me to explain what this is, what it does, and why it's important is Dhruva Rajendra, the CEO and co-founder of Deterrence, a defense technology company. Great to have you with us.
Great to be here.
So I feel a little bit like I'm in Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, but I have to ask you to explain the word of the day. What are energetics?
It's a fancy way of saying stuff that explodes. So energetic material goes into a number of things, from rocket motors to munitions. But yeah, at the end of the day, it's a chemical compound. It's chemicals that come together, and the output is large displacement of energy. And the output of it is, you know, can be other things, but in our context, is an explosion usually.
So this is not a new technology. It's been around for generations and generations, correct?
It's been around for generations and generations, you know, going back to Alfred Nobel or something like that. So what's fascinating, I think, about, you know, what we've been sort of focused on is, like, this industry is, you know, well over 100 years old. And oftentimes you will see in different factories and stuff like that that we go to the reminders of that. I mean, we've seen, as we've done factory tours and sites kind of across the industrial base, you know, you certainly see some new equipment, but every now and then you'll see sort of a relic that is still in production. We almost every factory you've gone to, you'll see something that's been in production since the 1940s and been in operation since the 1940s. I have been to one place that actually had a machine that's been working since the post-Civil War era, and people have just figured out ways to keep that thing working. So, yeah, it's a lot of it's been around for a long time. It's not necessarily the newest market, but it is critical. That's kind of what why we've been focused on it.
So why is it critical? Explain.
Yeah, well, at the end of the day, I mean, we say this internally a lot, like the energetics is the Achilles heel for the entire defense industrial base. It is something that is overlooked. So I think a lot of folks, you know, maybe you've been exposed to the term or the industry, but like haven't actually spent the time to understand all the different things it intersects. But at the end of the day, you know, anything that our warfighters kind of use from a munitions perspective, there is some form of energetic typically involved. That's not there. They're basically just hollow shells that they're shooting out there. So I mentioned, you know, a lot of these machines, a lot of the factories we've gone to are older, have been, you know, certainly left in neglect or some sort of state of disrepair. And, you know, over the last, especially like 20, 30 years, I think that was like the era where we sort of, as especially after the Global War on Terror ended, we kind of lost that capability to do production at scale.
So there are new ways to produce this, correct? New technologies can be brought to bear.
If you look at the last 10 years, there's been a lot of advancements in robotics, a lot of advancements in manufacturing, but those advancements haven't necessarily been translated in the appropriate way into this context. And so, you know, what we're focused on doing is bringing new technology to bear on this industry. The trick is to kind of marry it with, you know, the industry as it is today, and like a lot of the knowledge that's been developed over, to what we said earlier, decades and centuries in some cases.
You've mentioned robotics. Are there other new technologies that could make a difference in how these are manufactured, like AI, like 3D printing?
Yeah, absolutely. So another AI, absolutely. So the promise of AI is obviously able to see around, it's able to pattern match better than a human brain can in certain contexts. Part of what we believe will happen over the next 5 to 10 years is AI will be used to help us unlock some of the secrets of chemistry that have maybe eluded us. So one, if you know how the stuff works, you can make it safer, you can make it more reliable, you can just generally improve the quality of what you're making. And then the second one is you can unlock new capabilities theoretically. So if you're trying to make an artillery shell go further or faster, right, maybe there's a new chemical compound that AI can help you uncover that actually, like, you know, is able to sort of achieve that outcome. And so, yeah, the promise of AI really is, there's a few different places it plugs in, but the one I'm specifically the most keen to see as it play out over the next 10 years is really around, like, can we actually create like an AI chemist that helps us accelerate our learning of this kind of this sort of industry.
So if the old production techniques work, what are the clear advantages of going to new techniques? Would it give us a more resilient supply chain, for instance?
So one trade-off you make if you just do it only by the old way is a lot of the old way relies on a lot of human labor and a lot of human inputs in these factories. We just don't literally have the bodies to kind of keep up with the old way of doing things. And so you've got to find different opportunities to automate things, ways to make it safer, so that you can actually match the output that we want to get to kind of in the West, right? And so the old ways are good, but one problem is scale. The second, going back to the kind of the point about chemistry, is if you want to unlock new capabilities, if you want to develop new ways of delivering things to the warfighter, you're going to need to get a deeper understanding of the stuff. And that's why, you know, as you start to digitize more and more of these factories, right, we will be able to do that on much shorter timeframes. And maybe on that second point, to maybe unpack a little bit more, you know, it takes a very, very long time for something to go from an idea in a lab somewhere to the warfighter. I actually started my career working in biotech software. And the rule of thumb there is COVID drugs aside, like it's usually about 12 to 14 years for a drug to go from lab to, you know, into someone's arm or whatever. Like in a lot of cases we've seen it's much longer. It can be decades in between someone made a breakthrough and it actually makes its way into a munition system. And we don't think that's going to work. Kind of looking forward, like we need to figure out ways to compress that trial and error period so that we can keep up with what our peer adversaries are trying to do around the world.
Militarily, how do these advanced energetics, if you're able to develop them, how would they impact our warfighting capability?
Yeah, the answer is it kind of depends on which kind of capability you're looking at. Maybe to give you two different examples. So one, to kind of talk about stuff that's maybe more relevant in, say, like Ukraine, you know, we've developed a 155 shell. We're shipping a bunch of shells over there. If we were able to, like, crack new chemistries, we theoretically could extend the range of 155 shells. So basically create, you know, an overmatched capability for anyone using a 155 shell. Because again, the 155 shell, it's pretty old tech, right? And so new chemistry compound breakthroughs could actually lead to propellants that actually shoot it out further and faster kind of thing. In another context, I've seen companies that are basically developing new charges and stuff like that for, say, drones. So different way to put it is, you know, we've had Javelin missiles for a very long time. Javelins have what's called a tandem heat warhead in them. That tandem heat warhead is great for a Javelin, but it's not necessarily great for a mission a drone is trying to achieve. You know, drones are trying to be super precise. They might be trying to dive bomb. They might have some like weird weight thing that they're trying to balance to keep the like flight characteristics going or whatever. So like you might actually, so in those cases, you actually need to develop a new energetic, sometimes from scratch, to support a different type of mission. And to kind of extend that a little bit more, I think one thing that we believe should be part of the future thinking of the defense industrial base is the idea that you'll want to be able to support all these missions and it won't feel like a whole big thing. Like we aren't just like taking the Javelin warhead and just sticking it in 50 different drones. We should have like each drone has its own uniquely designed energetic or warhead that is designed for the problem that they're trying to discreetly solve for the warfighter.
What's Russia doing? What's China doing?
Yeah, I mean, we're certainly behind. China absolutely has, you know, they're very open with their research, so you can kind of keep a little bit of an eye on like where they're at. And yeah, they've been really trying to improve energetics. Energetics also kind of intersect with some of the stuff they're trying to achieve in, or at least what we do intersects with they're trying to achieve with their space and rocket programs. And so they are making big investments there. But I think the one that I'm more surprised about is actually Russia, right? So, you know, Russia kind of kicked off the war about 2-3 years ago in Ukraine. They were faced with sort of the same challenge. Hey, we need to really ramp up production of, for them, it's 152 shells. And they've been able to kind of keep up and then some, frankly, with their production capacity. And prior to the Ukrainian war, they were actually, you know, in some categories, the standard bearer on a lot of this stuff. And so, you know, when we think about the peer, those two as our peer adversaries, China is a real thing, but you know, Russia also is like in a lot of ways is actually the global leader and some of the stuff. And a play, and part of what we're trying to do is, you know, close that gap.
Why does the U.S. lag?
It's been a long journey, and that's gone on over the last couple of decades. But I think it's a few different things, right? So building energetics factories is inherently dangerous. In some contexts, it can be environmentally tough, right? So, you know, call it NIMBYism, call it whatever. Like the operations that we once had in this country have slowly over time been closed and moved to other places. So kind of a classic case that we started to outsource things that we maybe shouldn't have. The other one I would say is honestly like capitalism. So I'm as free market capitalist as they come. But the reality is that when demand curves go up and down, companies are forced to make decisions. And when they have an energetic facility, they sometimes want to say, you know what, like we've got this, we've got the big contract for X, Y, and Z. Why don't we figure out a way to kind of outsource this or consolidate different operations? And what happens on the other side is it's not just a production question. It starts to become a cost question, right? And so they're okay saying like, well, there's only one place we can do it. And now they used to charge $1 and they charge 20 now because of consolidation. Like to give you one concrete example, right? Primers for small caliber rounds. That market has been like really consolidated. There was actually a transaction that went through late last year where a company in Czechoslovakia now owns about 50-60% of small caliber primer production. Actually, J.D. Vance was the one who a year ago as senator, he actually tried to make an argument that, hey, if this transaction goes through, you know, somebody who we are not totally sure their intentions with these operations may start to, I mean, they will start to own, you know, our smaller caliber primer production. And a deal ended up going through. And like what you can guess will end up happening is that company, which is a private equity fund, will start to look at all these brands they've just bought and say, you know, we used to have 5 primer facilities, but really we can get by with 2 and that will be fine. And we, you know, our customers can basically take that burden. And so, yeah, I would say like that's the other piece is because we don't have Russia and China, and obviously their systems work significantly different than ours. But in this specific context, that's actually maybe not been helpful, I would say.
So what you're telling me is that the U.S. is reliant on other countries, some of them perhaps not allies, for production of these energetics that are absolutely critical to our military hardware. Is that right?
We're trying to reverse that quickly. But yes, that's the short answer. Yeah, I mean, like one of the biggest companies in the world in this category, in the small caliber category I was just talking about, is a company called Murian out of Russia. They used to sell in the United States, but sales for them were stopped in the US in 2021, so before the invasion. When that happens, it's not just a light switch that can just turn back on, right? So we cut them off, prices start to climb back up, and then people look around and say, well, can someone else go sort of stand up a primer manufacturing capability? Well, we have challenges too. It's, again, you have to go through all sorts of crazy permitting and things like that. So that's, so short answer is yes, that's been historically true. And if you look at other parts of the supply chain, it, you know, that there's definitely risks across there.
That sounds like a huge vulnerability to me. Is it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the key critical materials that goes into primers is antimony. And China is one of the biggest holders of it. It's one of those minerals up there with tungsten and some others that they have, not a monopoly, but like, you know, whatever's like a leg or two down from that. So, you know, it's one of the things that kind of keeps us up at night is like, how do we find sources that are, you know, friendly or at ideally in the U.S. If we can help it. So, yes, it is absolutely a huge risk.
From what I've read, the Department of Defense and Congress are aware of the issue. In your opinion, are they doing enough to address it?
You know, I think they're trying as hard as they can. I mean, we've actually, you know, we've been around as a company for about a year, and we've been able to move pretty quickly because our customer is so aware of the problem and such a supportive partner. Yes, we deal with some of the normal stuff that companies kind of coming in for the first time deal with. Trying to align a lot of stakeholders is not, but like at the end of the day, everyone is sort of aligned that like, we need to get this problem right. Right. It's not like in other categories where I have friends who have drone companies or, you know, where there's still some debate on, well, you know, drones are big over there, but is it really a thing here? It's like, nope, everyone's like, we're going to, like, if we go to war with China tomorrow, we have 7 weeks of ammo, fix it.
Explain to me, if you would, exactly what deterrence does and how it fits into this landscape.
Absolutely. So deterrence is basically building robots that manufacture energetics and energetic components. The goal is to basically, again, expand production and shorten those trial and error kind of timeframes, and to close the munitions gap with China and Russia. So we've been about a year. My co-founders and I have built other stuff before. We co-founded a company called Latch before that did smart locks and smart devices, and then found ourselves really concerned about the defense industrial base, and so got started here. A lot of the team also comes from Tesla. So my other co-founder, Henry, was one of the people that helped launch a lot of their program, battery programs specifically, over the last 4 to 5 years. A lot of shared skill sets. So one of the things we found is that a lot of folks who worked in, this is funny, electric vehicles and battery manufacturing in the last 5 years have a very translatable skill set into the work we're doing now.
Are there barriers to new entrants like your company?
You've got permitting barriers. You've got, like, the skepticism you have to overcome with the customer that says, hey, you know, you've never done this before, or like, you're newcomers to the space. Like, how are you going to fix what we've been doing for, again, in sometimes a century? And so, there's a number of barriers like that. But I think that, you know, our team is super focused on this mission because it's frankly what keeps us all up at night. And we've been sort of lucky, I would say, to find a customer base that, you know, really understands the problem and is super aligned with helping us get on the field quickly.
You mentioned that you think there is awareness of what the core issue is here. Are there some additional steps that you would like to see the federal government take to catch up?
Well, I think one thing that the industry talks a lot about is getting more consistent about the demand cycle for munitions. So, you know, going back to after the global war on terror, you know, obviously demand went down significantly for everything from small caliber to large caliber kind of items. And so, you know, a lot of times the industry will say, like, hey, can you just, like, give us better confidence that if we buy a new 155 line, you're still going to be buying these things 3 to 5 years from now? So I think that's one. The second one, though, I think is the customer policymakers should start to hold companies more accountable that they are building with the thought they may have to pivot more than once. So what that means is, like, a lot of these factories are set up to do one thing super well. So they'll build a line, it'll be amazing, but it'll only do, like, one key thing, right? And so sometimes, you know, I've talked about going to factories and you see a lot of old machines. I also see a lot of new machines that aren't doing anything. So, like, they were bought in the last 3 to 5 years. When was the last time someone used this? Maybe like 2 years ago. So they have these beautiful lines set up. Demand kind of changes, and now you've got, you've got a bunch of beautiful equipment that's not being utilized. So I think the second thing, which is more of a policy thing, is to push companies to look for things that can be more flexible. I mean, to come back to a little bit what deterrence is doing, what we're building is a generalizable robotic solution. So the idea is the same robot that can work on the small caliber primer line can also work on 40 millimeter rounds. It can work on other sort of problems. And that way, you're not, every time there's, like, a new thing that pops up, you're starting from scratch and you're having to build everything from the ground up. So I think that second piece of, like, making a flexible industrial base is something over the next 3 years we really have to get right.
What's at stake if we don't do that?
Well, we called the company Deterrence, and we were pretty, I would say, it was literal for a reason, right? I was actually on a panel earlier this week where the question was, how long is it until we no longer have industrial deterrence, if you will? And I said, I mean, my answer was, like, that already passed. That passed maybe like 2 years ago, or that was exhibited 2 years ago, but maybe it's been longer since we've actually, like, that anybody has been afraid of America's ability to manufacture things at scale. We've just been proving everyone right over the last 3 years that, you know, we can't keep up with even a small conflict. So I think if we don't get this right, yeah, we're no, like, those peer adversaries become a little bit more nervous. And to the, again, to what we called the company in the first place, we don't actually have deterrence, and the security blanket that we've enjoyed for the last 40 years goes away, frankly.
How urgent is this?
I think within defense, it's probably the most urgent thing. Like, how fast can we not just produce energetics, but all the stuff that we need in case something happens? Like, I'm hard pressed to think of anything that like takes priority over that, frankly.
Is Ukraine a case study of what's wrong?
Ukraine's a case study, and I'll give you, I think Israel's a case study too. So if about, I think it's been a little over a year since, you know, that big attack that Iran did in retaliation to one of Israel's attacks, right? And the sort of combined effort to defeat that attack was a billion and a half or something, or 1.2 billion, I think was the number. And so the problem is like the math doesn't actually pencil out, right? It's not that we don't have money. It's the problem is that we take money and we try to shove it into our industrial base, and our industrial base only tries to solve problems with money rather than rethinking the technology from the ground up. When you just try to solve problems with money, everything starts to get more expensive, right? When you start to think from first principles, ground up, how would I do that with where the world is at today, where technology is at today, you start to find ways to kind of make, you know, bring those costs down. But that is just not how the industry thinks today. It's not really how even the like incentives are set up at a policy level. So there's a lot of things that need to come together and a lot of like a shift in perspective that needs to happen that says like, hey, the mission is to get to cost parity or close, pretty close, because none of this stuff pencils out.
You sound pretty pessimistic.
Well, I sound pessimistic, but I wouldn't be working on this if I wasn't optimistic that we could figure this out.
Thank you, Dhruva Rajendra, CEO and co-founder of Deterrence. I've now added the word energetics to my vocabulary. Thank you very much for that. And thank you to our listeners. This has been NatSec Tech from the Special Competitive Studies Project. I'm Jean Meserve. I hope you'll join us again. Until then, take care.